We have been studying the book of Hebrews, and we have worked our way partway through it. And the book of Hebrews provides an encouragement to its readers to remain faithful to Christ, to remain faithful to Christ, and not to fall back on trusting one's comfortable religious system or anything else. Do we need that encouragement today? And how? There are all kinds of things that would pull us away from our complete and total faithfulness to Christ. So how does the author of Hebrews do that? He basically points us to Christ and says, look at him. Focus on Christ. Notice who he is, what he's done, the significance of who Christ is. He is greater. He is superior than anything else, than any other system or whatever else out there. So he does that by emphasizing the superiority of Christ and by pointing out our loss from unfaithfulness. And he isn't saying you're going to lose your salvation. He's saying you're going to lose your rewards, as we've already noted looking at the first of the warning passages, the first of the five warning passages. And last time, we finished up with right near the end of the passage that we looked at. There was a verse near the conclusion of the passage we looked at last time. It said, therefore, in all things, he had to be made like his brethren, and we had noted something of the significance of the incarnation, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in all things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Now, there's a lot there. We touched on some of the details, but one of the things you need to recognize is there's a focus on this high priest idea. Because Christ is a high priest. He's going to sort of begin to talk a little bit about it now. He's going to expand on it much more later. And that's kind of how the author goes. He'll touch on some things, bring it up, and then come back to it or expand on it. But there are two words that are particularly going to be emphasized, merciful and faithful, as it relates to the high priest. So when we think of what's coming next, we should be thinking something about the context of priestliness, things relating to the priesthood. Now, how many of you this week sometime thought about the priesthood? I think we have two. Why? Didn't you go to a priest this week? Well, you are a priest, so you didn't have to. I mean, if you understand the, and we'll think about that some more. But that's not common in our vocabulary, or at least our usual thinking, because that was part of an era gone by. But is there some significance to this? Yes. Well, so think about these two words, merciful and faithful. The author is going to pick those up and deal with them in reverse order and expand something on them. But he first is going to review something of faithfulness. And so we want to look at the structure of what's coming. Hebrews 3, 1 through 6 is exposition. He's kind of expanding on the idea of faithfulness, talking particularly about the faithfulness of Christ. Then he will give the second warning in Hebrews 3, 7 through 4, 14, and he gives an exhortation, remain faithful. That theme seems to come up time and time again. And then chapter 4, 15 through 5, 10, he'll give some more exposition. He'll expand on the merciful idea. So you'll notice there's faithfulness focused on in 3, 1 through 6, and then the merciful idea, those two words, were brought out in verse 17 of chapter 2. So he's expanding on these ideas. So the author steadily develops his argument, and that's what you see. Now, if you just pick up the book of Hebrews and read a piece here and there, you're not going to get the big picture. And so you really need to, and that's why we keep kind of backing up a little bit and saying, well, how does this all fit together? Because this is one basic sermon that he's preaching, and it's building. So we need to kind of keep that in our thinking as we look through this. So he's developing his argument, and he started right off at the beginning by talking about how Christ was superior or greater than angels. And then he talks about Christ being the author of so great a salvation, and that he was great enough to take on humanity in the incarnation to accomplish it. And now he's going to give a comparison with Moses, who was one who was viewed as a great person in the eyes of the Jews. And it's hard to get good footage of Moses, but there's one I'm sure you recognize. Looks a little bit like Charlton Heston, but where do we get this comparison thing? Well, it seems that Moses is mentioned about 850 times in the Bible. You can go back through and count them. The Jews did not hesitate to identify themselves with Moses, and they communicated their identity with Moses in contrast to wanting to identify themselves with Christ. And this passage, John chapter 9, verses 28 to 29, communicates this. It says, "Then they reviled him," that is the man who had been born blind, "and said, 'You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from.'" So what did the Jews think of Jesus? Not much. What did they think of Moses? A whole lot. So they were not hesitant to communicate that. That's kind of the thing that's communicated here. This comparison is not the first time that it's done. And so when the author of Hebrews makes this comparison, there's good reason to do so because of the great interest and concern and identification that the Jewish people had with Moses. And of course, the book of Hebrews is called the book of Hebrews because it seems to be speaking to those who were of the Hebrew or Jewish background, and they had a tendency to want to back away from Christ and pull back toward their Judaism. And so that's kind of what's being emphasized here. So the author is wanting to identify the faithful nature of Christ and show that Christ is faithful. Moses was faithful, but Christ was even more so. That's the basic idea. I guess we could be done then. Well, I think we should expand on that. Just checking to see if you're still awake, see if you're still with me. All right. No, we're not done yet. So we are exhorted to consider an exemplary and superior model. But notice how he starts off. Therefore, based on the things that he'd already said, because it's a continuing discussion and argument, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus. Let's focus on that first part of this. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, because that tells you something of how the author views those that he's writing to. And he sees that they are believers. Believers are recognized as saints by the common standard. There is a common standard that is communicated. We are all of us believers are considered saints. We are those who are set apart to God, from evil and to God. So they are identified as those who are set aside to God. And that's their present status, and it's an ongoing process. We're set aside positionally, but progressively we're still in process in our growth, in our separating ourselves unto God and from this evil world, those things that are part of this world. They are identified as part of the family of God. brethren. Holy brethren. This is their past provision. They are adopted by Christ as family, and that's the identity that they have. And so the author doesn't hesitate to use that kind of designation. And then they are identified as those who will be with God. Their heavenly calling, it has really two ideas, because on the one hand, they're called from heaven, God calling them from there, but also being called unto heaven as our destiny. And so there, that is the future experience. So there's a past element and a future element as well. The point is that those that the author of Hebrews is writing to are considered believers. They are holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling. And it's important to note that so that when we see admonitions that are coming along, we don't mistake and confuse them and think that he's speaking to these people as to unbelievers. And so he's encouraging them to remain faithful through whatever obstacles there are. That's what he's going to be leading toward. So he says, therefore, holy brethren, and then focusing on what the emphasis is, and this is really a command here, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus. So if you wanted to simplify it and focus on what's the bare bones of what he's saying here, it says, consider Christ Jesus. Why? Because he is faithful to the one who appointed him. That's the emphasis. Because you can get lost in all the peripheral phrases. So notice that that's the point here. So Christ is recognized as faithful by the ultimate standard. Christ is to be recognized for his ultimate faithfulness because there isn't anyone who exceeds him in his faithfulness for a number of reasons, and we've touched on some of them. But he's the one that we are to consider. And again, I already pointed out, this is a command, not a suggestion, because there isn't anyone else like him. Reminds me of the book of Job, when Satan came before the Lord, and before God, and he said to him, "Have you considered my servant Job?" It's another use of the same basic idea. Now, we're to consider Christ as the ultimate example. Job was the ultimate example that God was giving to Satan as someone who was faithful to him and proved it throughout the book that it was for good reason. And it wasn't just because God was doing fine things for him. Then we see Christ is to be the center of our confession as believers. Christ is the one who was sent from the Father. So when the Jews said, "We don't know where he's from," I think he told them more than once where he's from. He came from the Father, but they didn't like to hear that. He is a sent one. He uses the term apostle. What does apostle mean? It means a sent one, one who is sent, often sent with orders coming from the Father. And also he is a sent one, and also he is a priest, or the one who made the ultimate sacrifice for us before God. Because what does a priest do? Often involved in making a provision for us before God. And a provision was usually in the form of a sacrifice, which was anticipating something that was to come. So, and then Christ is recognized as faithful to the one who sent him. And that is the ultimate standard. So he's being measured not against us. He didn't say compared to the majority of people in the world today, Jesus is better. That would sound pretty good. If he was talking about us, we might say, "Wow, that's going some." I mean, compared to 90%. Wow, we're that good? No, there's a higher standard. I wonder how many of us would jump into that 90% as it is. we'd like to think, perhaps. So he's not measured by the standards of the world, but by the ultimate standard, faithful to the one who sent him. By what standard do we measure our faithfulness? Do you ever think about that? Let's see, how faithful am I? Let me think. Oh, there's that person. Yeah, I'm better than that person. Oh, and then there's that one. Yeah, I'm better than that one too. And we try not to think about anybody who might be better than we are and don't want to bring that up before the Lord because maybe we can pull one off on him. But what do we compare ourselves to? I mean, that's kind of what's being communicated here. There is no higher standard than God himself as the one that he is being judged and validated by. So that's a good reminder. Are we faithful to the one who sends us? Because he says, I send you into the world. We are sent ones as well. But we tend to be satisfied with a lesser standing or a lesser standard because it makes us feel better about ourselves. But is there any standard that Christ does not live up to? Is there any standard that we don't live up to? We don't have to look very far. So, what about the most recognized standard of Judaism? Moses. How did Jesus compare to him? Who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. Hebrews 3:2. Now, this is a partial quote from Numbers chapter 12 and verse 7, which says, "Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house." Faithful in all my house. And this was the occasion in Numbers chapter 12 when Miriam and Aaron had a little problem with Moses regarding his wife, who was a Cushite or Ethiopian. And they said, basically, is God only speaking through you, Moses? Here's Miriam, his older sister, and Aaron, his older brother. Now, I don't know about you, but I've got a couple of older brothers. And they're not real keen on a younger brother telling them anything about anything that's more significant than anything that they come up with. Maybe it's just my brothers, but I doubt it. I think you can all relate to that. So God had to show them that, no, I am speaking through Moses. So this is sort of in the background here. So Moses was recognized as faithful by an inferior standard, but still faithful. And not a bad standard, it just wasn't quite as high of a standard. So a thought about the choice of Moses for comparison. He was associated with the inception of the nation, the Exodus. Remember back to Exodus chapter 3 and 4, where Moses was out in the desert minding the sheep and his own business, and the burning bush appeared, and God said, I got this great idea. I want you to go to Egypt and bring my people out. Okay? And I think you remember how well that went. Moses was a little bit like we sometimes are. Here am I, Lord, send Aaron. And anyway, they worked that out eventually. The entire Jewish religious system came through the instrumentality of Moses, obtained on Sinai. So it was all sort of wrapped up in Moses. And the Jews looked at the situation in such terms. And so Moses was identified as their key person. Now, they didn't disregard Abraham or Isaac or Jacob, but Moses was the, because he was the one who saw the nation come to reality as part of their movement from bondage to freedom, and pictured their salvation being saved out of that bondage, and then bringing them to the place in Sinai where they now were a sort of a unified people, a nation where they hadn't been. They'd just been a tribe before when they had gone into Egypt. So then now they are given a covenant and the Constitution essentially rules to live by. So Moses was all part of that. I mean, he was like greater than George Washington. I mean, we looked back to George Washington and he was quite a person. But this is bigger than that. Christianity is centered on Christ. Judaism was centered on Moses. So that's the comparison that's there. Then the choice of a standard for comparison. The comparison of Moses was in relation to his house. And that's looking at a quote. So we are wondering, what is that that's in view? It may refer to his responsibilities regarding the house of God. He was instrumental in seeing the tabernacle come to reality. He was sort of the mediator of its design coming from God, but he saw that it became reality, part of the preparation, the maintenance. He saw all of that kind of come together. So he was associated with that. It may refer to his brethren as of the household of Israel, all his house. So in comparison to all of his house, the word that's used here, oikos, is house. It could be house as in literally the building and whatever. It could be a broader house like the temple, the house of God kind of thing. Or it can be household. Can be used either way. So both options are possible. And in either case, it comes out to an inferior comparison. Yet, Moses was exemplary. He was one to be held up high. Jesus was faithful according to the standard of him who sent him, God the Father. Moses was faithful in comparison to his brethren and according to his service among the people. So it was high, but not the same. It was inferior. So then, we are inclined to follow good but inferior models. For this one, referring to Christ, has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. And I'm curious how many of you recognize that guy there. If you have kids, you might. Obviously your favorite character, I'm sure. But the picture of the builder is going to be significant here. The rationale of the builder, what is he thinking about? Well, the divine rating is superior to a temporal rating. By God's rating, Christ is worthy of more glory. You know, there are different rating systems. There's a rating system for institutions. It's called accreditation. And that is a standard that the state or the government or whatever gives. And then there's the rating that God gives. And sometimes there's a problem between those two. And we often look for accreditation of institutions. And sometimes, in order to pursue that accreditation, it causes a dilution of the institution. And that can be an issue of concern. So the rating system is significant. and needs to be considered. Now, why was Christ considered more worthy of glory? Partly because of who he was and all that he was before any of this happened, because of his origin. Well, is origin even the right word to use? He's always existed. It doesn't even fit. Does Moses have a similar kind of thing? No, so obviously right from the get-go, of course, that assumes that we recognize that Christ is who he says he was. The practical reality is that the producer is greater than the product. The producer is greater than the product. Is God as creator greater than his creation? Now, that should be a no-brainer for us to come to that realization. Is the builder actually greater than the building? Well, that's not hard to figure out. I mean, the building might be impressive, but where did the building come from? The mind and skill of the builder, or maybe it came from the architect, but in conjunction with the builder, because the builder has to use the architectural plans to bring it to reality, but the idea is still there. Now, Moses was responsible for getting Israel's religious and national system in order, and it was by God's plan and God's enablement all along the way. It wasn't something that Moses just dreamed up. But Christ was there in the process and may have even been visibly seen in theophany. So in the process, Christ is identified with God, as is the case in John 1:1-3 as well. One commentator said this: whereas Moses served faithfully in the system of worship that the tabernacle represented, Jesus Christ designed that system of worship. These verses are a powerful testimony to the deity of Jesus Christ. If God built everything and Jesus Christ built God's house, Jesus Christ is God. Is there any question then that he is greater? No, I don't think so. It should be obvious. Christ was the ultimate builder of the tabernacle and of Israel, and Moses is recognized as their servant. And Moses indeed was faithful, looking at verse 5, in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. So, the inclination of the observer, one who is standing by, like the Jews were, looking at Moses, they would come to the conclusion Moses is very important person, responsible for many things. So it's expected that Moses is held in high esteem. That's not a surprise. But he is recognized as functioning in the capacity of a servant, not as the architect, not as the originator. The word for servant here is not the one that we normally think of as like deacon, diakonos, but it's therapon, where we might get our word therapy, one who freely renders personal service is the idea. Now, if you're thinking about the context of the tabernacle and a high priest, because that was mentioned, we might think, well, why isn't Aaron mentioned here? Aaron was the high priest. He will be in due time. But Moses was responsible for things even before that, because he was part of establishing through God, putting Aaron in place and all that. But he was a Levite nonetheless. So as such, he was preparing something that would serve as a model for a later time. That is the tabernacle. He was part of putting that in place. Solomon's temple, the return temple, which was later renovated by Herod and expanded some. Those came using a similar picture of things, different design and structure in some ways, but the same basic format. And then there would be another one. The tabernacle was a model of the real temple from which Christ would eventually reign. That was referred to in Hebrews 1:8 and chapter 2:8, that he's going to be the one who reigns and is over everything. And so there's an anticipation of something that is to come. This preparation through Moses anticipated the Messiah's rule on earth. And those who were to come after Moses, the prophets, would expand on this more fully, that which is spoken afterward, the text says. And there's an observation that we ought to make here, and that is that Jesus Christ will not serve then as he did in the first advent, but he will reign and he will be the king, and that will be evident in the millennium and in the new heaven and the new earth. And so unlike Moses, he is not God's servant, but he is God's son, and he will sit on his throne, and he is the possessor of all things. But it's natural for us to focus on personalities and the accomplishments of those that are around us, like Moses and others in our world, and get distracted from the real one behind everything so that we miss the big picture. And so we need to recognize that and be reminded of that. And then we are expected to embrace our place with confidence. What is our place in all of this? Verse 6 of Hebrews 3 says, "But Christ as a son over his own house, whose house we are, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end." So we need to recognize that place that we are. And we show that we are of his house by our faithfulness to him. And that's not a question of whether or not we will be saved, but is as to whether we will gain the rewards that he wants to give us. And we've mentioned that before. So we are privileged residents of Christ's household. And residents may not be the best word, but it communicates something of the idea. A house was promised to a future faithful priest. 1 Samuel 2:35 says, "Then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before my anointed forever." So there is the idea of one who will be raised up. Will Christ serve as a priest? Yeah, high priest, that's been referenced, and we'll see more of that. A house was promised to a future ruling king. 1 Chronicles 17:14, "I will establish him in my house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forever." Now, there's a few things to note here. This is a direct application to David's immediate son, but also has future application to David's ultimate son, referring to Christ. There's a direct application to God's house as the temple, but also to God's household, his people. And God's household consists of people, not lumber and stone. And so we are ultimately included in the broader designation of God's people. And we are expected to function in his house as priests. Remember, that's part of the emphasis that's communicated here. The writer was thinking of priestly functions, as the context seems to make fairly evident. His concern was that his readers might not remain faithful to God. He was concerned that they were slipping in their resolve to be faithful, and particularly to keep Christ as their object and concern. Rather, they were slipping back to a concern for Moses and the things of the Jewish worship system. And as such, that would result in their losing their privilege as priests in the sense of their intimate fellowship with God and the opportunity to represent God before people and people before God. And this is what the Israelites as a whole lost. If you think back to the occasion on Mount Sinai, when Moses had gone up the mountain, Exodus 32, and he was gone for a while. And while he was up there, something crazy happened. Remember what that was? The people said, "We don't know what's happened to Moses. We're ready for something else. Let's get moving here. We're tired of sitting around. There's a lot of crazy, scary stuff going up on that mountain, and Moses might be dead." And so what did Aaron do? He said, "Okay, bring me your gold." And he fashioned a calf out of it. And that worked out real well. Now, there were some problems that came from that. What had he said prior to that? Israel was given the opportunity to be a kingdom of priests. Exodus 19:6, and it's quoted by Peter. "And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." But it didn't go so well. And when Moses came back down from the mountain and asked Aaron what happened, you remember Aaron's incredibly brilliant response. "Well, I put this gold in this pot and this calf jumped out." And yeah, that's convincing. And what did Moses do? Moses said, "Okay, who's with me on this thing?" And who was with him? Who stood with him? It was the Levites. And so the Levites became the... Now, whether this was, you know, directly cause-effect is not particularly germane, but the point is that rather than everyone functioning as a priest, there was just one group, and this group was faithful at this time. And it may be at least illustrative of this point. So God limited the privilege of serving as priest to the Levites when the rest of the nation apostatized at that time, and they were judged accordingly. So is it possible for us to forfeit the privilege of functioning as a priest in the future? It's an interesting question. 1 Peter 2:5 says, "You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Are we living up to that expectation with the spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God? Are we providing a vehicle of communication, or at least a visible avenue to God by the way we live? Is that the case? Well, the writer's point in this passage is that his readers should follow the example of faithfulness to God that Moses and Jesus set, though Jesus was clearly exemplary beyond that, and not lose their privilege as priests. Because priests represent people to God. They exercise leadership of people toward God. The author of Hebrews had previously warned his readers that faithfulness could result in their drifting away from God's truth. That was the first warning, chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. So by contrast, Jesus and Moses are given as examples to help his readers appreciate the superiority of Jesus Christ over Moses, to encourage them to continue with Christ and not deviate from that, returning to a system that they were simply more comfortable with. The lesson for us is to be so impressed, with the superiority of Christ as a faithful son that we emulate and appreciate him and appreciate our place with him as his children, because we are his brethren and, I always want to say sisters. It's sometimes hard to grasp the nature of our relationship with God in and through Christ. The spiritual nature of it does not always seem as real as it ought to, because we're so caught up in our senses. We're sensory people. But there's a spiritual dimension that may go beyond our senses. Just like there are other things around us that are beyond our senses, our unaided senses. How many of you have seen a virus without using a microscope? You know they're there. Or what about your cell phone? How does that crazy thing work? It sends signals, waves or whatever, through the air. Have you ever seen one of those? We've got them zapping us all the time, all over the place, but we can't see them. What does that tell us? It tells us that there are limits to our ability to perceive or to see or to sense. There are things that we can't see. So it shouldn't be that much of a surprise for us that there's a spiritual realm that we can't necessarily use our senses to see, but it's every bit as real. Every bit as real, and we need to be reminded of that. When we sin and feel guilty, we know that our guilt is real before a holy God. We need to be careful not to neglect the spiritual realm. And therefore, we need to come back to Christ. Yeah, there's a spiritual relationship that we have with him, but don't come to the place of feeling like, well, it's not as clear, it's not as obvious as I'd like it to be. Just come back to, okay, is a virus real? Are all these waves that are out there real? X-rays, microwaves, short waves, long waves, you name the waves. There are all kinds of them. And we see just a very tiny spectrum of visible light. Don't miss the superiority of Christ and remain faithful to him. That's what we need to remember.